All right. Welcome everyone in the Sendo and on Zoom. Oh, yes. Change the. Where's the Sendo camera? Oh, there we go. Yep. You could be, you know, there's always the socially distanced aspect too, but however you guys want to do it. All right, I will begin as usual by greeting everybody. I'll start with the folks on Zoom, and then in the Sendo, each person will say their name and we will repeat it. So I'll start with Bob.
Bob.
Phil.
Phil.
Bruce.
Bruce.
Moved into your new home, I'm assuming. Etzido. Let's see, okay, everybody just rearranged. Pat. Yeshe Tsoki.
Yeshe
Tsoki. Mark.
Mark.
Paulette.
Paulette.
Jeannie.
Jeannie.
Rosemary.
Rosemary.
Ellen.
Ellen.
Alice.
Alice.
Chris.
Chris.
Vin.
Vin.
Lisa.
Lisa.
Dennis.
Michael,
Brian, Mick,
Andy,
Linda R, Camille,
Ken,
Sabrina, and Ruth Ann. And in the Sendo,
Dave,
Cinda,
Katie,
Linda B. Jim. All right. Nice big group today. Let's see. In terms of announcements, there is a one-day retreat at the end of the month, Saturday, January 29th. And part-time, full-time, in-person, on Zoom participation is welcome. Also, we do have a term student program that will be starting in February. There's more information on that that'll be coming in the newsletter, but also on our website. If you look, a lot of times we have it in the top menu, but at the very least, it's under, I think it's under like vows, term students on there anyway. You can probably search for it. And it tells you the dates of the beginning and ending retreat. So couple month commitment where you create your own vows and a group supports one another in that. Also, we do have the dates for Jukai and precept study set. So Sunday, June 5th will be our annual Jukai ceremony where people can formally become Buddhists and receive the precepts. And we will be studying the precepts for 10 Tuesdays before that. Stay tuned for that. Any questions about any of that or other announcements I should make? Okay. All right. So today, I'm going to call this talk Right Confidence. And by right, I mean right as in like the Eightfold Noble Path, right view, right intention, right speech. And the way that term is used is not right as in right as opposed to wrong, you know, like some kind of moral judgment, but right as in that's the right key for the door. Like right as in it works. So we're going to be exploring that. So first, I wanted to play you a song, which at first you may not be obvious how it relates, but I will get to that. And in particular, it's just a 2-minute song, and it will. I want you to pay particular attention to there's three times the chorus comes up, and it changes a little bit each time. So that's the most important aspect of it. And this is a song, if any of you are curious, by an artist called Daniel Johnston. And he died in 2019, very, very quirky guy with lots of mental health issues over the course of his life, but very creative. And he's widely recognized now as being quite a wonderful songwriter, but he also like recorded his own music. And you know, it's like, I don't know, I'm Gen X and we like this kind of thing. It's like, it's kind of like bad, but it's good in part because it's bad. So he lived in Texas and recorded in his garage or his basement and just made cassette tapes and started handing them out to people. So that's how he became known. It's just like, there's just this guy playing this chord organ and singing along with his funky voice. And, you know, that's how I encountered him first, was this like cassette tape that I got in college with like, you know, a little label on it. And, you know, it was probably, he probably just had a little cassette replicator. Anyway, I will share that song. Hopefully I have share audio all on and everything will go great.
I'm getting closer to the fact. I've turned my back on silly dreams. I'm walking down that lonely road in my heavy load. I didn't bother to bring it when the sun shines down on me. I feel like I deserve it when the sun.
Okay.
What's his name again?
Daniel Johnston. So the three verses, or the three chorus verses, the sun shines down on me, I feel like I deserve it. The sun shines down on me, I want to feel like I deserve it. And the sun shines down on me, I feel like I have to earn it. I feel like this is a very poignant expression of something existential that many of us experience. It's kind of subtle. So I want to start from the end and work back. So starting from I feel like I have to earn it. So this may be a conviction that we have consciously or intellectually, but that's not necessary. Certainly we may carry that sense of like, oh, you know, I'm carrying the burden of the world, but you may not even have that necessarily, but still just have this sense, can be unspecific, that we have to earn it. Life, support, love, acceptance by working, by being responsible, by being likable, supportive of others, moral, strong, attractive, clever, kind, mindful, insightful, appreciative, creative, patient, you know, and any of our redeeming qualities, you might say. And to some extent, this view, of course, makes sense. So I'm going to be talking a little bit about the two aspects of reality as we describe them in Zen, often described as relative and absolute, but I have been describing them as two dimensions of reality, because it really gets to this sense that there's not just one dimension. Reality has the two, well, it has three, whatever, but in this framing, it has two dimensions. It can't have only one of them. So the two are simultaneously true and don't obstruct one another. So in the dependent dimension of reality, the dimension of space and time and causality, the relative, we have to take care of our lives. We have to work. We have to keep our responsibilities. We have to be nice to people if we want to be accepted and supported by them. So in that, and the just, I'm going to talk about the independent dimension in a bit, but just to, you know, compare. So like the dependent dimension is the dimension of space, time, and causality. And the independent is essentially dimensionless. It is right here, right now. It is just this, which is essentially the only thing that's actually real. Anything else is an abstraction, you know, that we kind of piece together in our mind as a narrative. Just this, just now. But both dimensions are true. So I'll get more to the independent dimension later. But in the dependent, we earn our comfort, our acceptance, our financial stability. We earn our retirement, if we're lucky enough to have one. In a sense, we kind of earn our health. I mean, we have to take care of our health, or as opposed to abuse our body. We earn our happiness. We even work at that in our spiritual practice. We earn our days off and our vacations and our rest. And while this is true, what are the drawbacks to this transactional view of our lives? I didn't make an exhaustive list, but a couple of the things I thought of was stress. Our work is never done. We have to just, you know, keep on earning our place. Constant evaluation of our performance in comparison with our own goals and standards, or communally held goals and standards, or comparison to others. A concern about what if we can't manage at some point, or we're in the middle of not managing right now. There's something existential here, because in addition to, you know, we might be concerned about, like, you know, now I'll be poor, or, you know, suffer consequences in the relative world, but there's an aspect of kind of shame as well in that if we can't earn it, we can't manage, that not just in relative conditions might change, but like we don't belong anymore. And even deeper, if we earn even our rest and retirement, if we earn in a subtle way, we have to earn even the sun's warmth and the clean air, then we have this sense that our life depends on the existence and worthiness of our small self. Our small conventional self, the one that does the work and makes the plans and with that. So there's a sense of alienation from life and from each other and from the earth. So I want to feel like I deserve it. Is there an alternative way? And I think it can be difficult for us to even imagine it sometimes. So I wanted to share with you something that I encountered fairly recently that helped me just question my assumptions and open up to a different possibility. So I have been listening to Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Kimmerer, who is a botanist and professor and an indigenous has indigenous North American ancestry. So her book explores the relationship between human beings and nature, other living things, what we can learn from living things, and really questioning our predominant Western scientific mechanistic view of our relationship with nature. So she says, you know, if you see somebody tending a garden carefully, you might say, you know, she loves that garden. But we generally wouldn't say the garden loves her. And why not? So she talks about the exchange between plants and people over the course of evolution, how we've selected fruits and grains based on our appetites and needs, and we cared and tended for them. We make sure their seeds get planted, and then we, you know, make sure that they are taken care of. And so she says, perhaps, and over time, then these become, you know, quote unquote, domesticated crops. She says, perhaps the plants have domesticated us. Wild plants have changed to stand in well-behaved rows. And wild humans have changed to settle alongside the fields and care for the plants, a kind of mutual taming. So she continues, and I've got my fingers crossed that I can read through this without tearing up. I sat once in a graduate writing workshop on relationships to the land. The students all demonstrated a deep respect and affection for nature. They said that nature was the place where they experienced the greatest sense of belonging and well-being. They professed without reservation that they loved the earth. And then I asked them, do you think that the earth loves you back? No one was willing to answer that. It was as if I had brought a two-headed porcupine into the classroom. Unexpected, prickly. They backed slowly away. Here was a room full of writers, passionately wallowing in unrequited love of nature. So I made it hypothetical and asked, what do you suppose would happen if people believed this crazy notion that the earth loved them back? The floodgates opened. They all wanted to talk at once. We were suddenly off the deep end, heading for world peace and perfect harmony. One student summed it up, you wouldn't harm what gives you love. Knowing that you love the earth changes you, activates you to defend and protect and celebrate. But when you feel the earth loves you in return, that feeling transforms the relationship from a one-way street into a sacred bond. So when we encounter things that, you know, open us up to something new, some new possibility, You know, something resonates. Like, I didn't know I needed that. I wasn't walking around going like, oh, I feel such alienation from the earth. But when I read that, I realize, oh, wow, there's a loneliness and an incompleteness and a sense of alienation in there that longs for that kind of possibility. The possibility that we aren't simply a burden, a consumer, fighting for our portion of the resources, or earning our right to breathe and take up space, ultimately taking more than we give in a transactional interaction that leaves the earth worse off for us having lived. So that brings us to "The Sun Shines Down on Me. I Want to Feel Like I Deserve It." Recognize how limiting is the view that we have to earn the sun's warmth. Exploring other possibilities. And we want to shed our limited view, but the best we can come up with at first is really, I want to feel like I have earned it. It's not even like I feel like I deserve it. I want to feel like I have earned it, which is still transactional. But maybe we have want to, you know, feel like we've reached a place where we've done enough, we're good enough. We don't have to worry about it. This still isn't quite it. So what does it feel like? The sun shines down on me. I feel like I deserve it. And I think this is more pure and innocent than I feel like I have earned it. It's more like a child's attitude. That is, a child who has been cared for and had her needs met. Confident, unquestioning, the issue of worthiness or earning something doesn't arise. The world is just here to fulfill my needs. There's a lack in this way of self-consciousness. Engagement, there's engagement and appreciation that stops short of gratitude, actually, because gratitude requires a sense of separation, sense of someone receiving something from someone else or something else. So there's a receiving, but neither with a sense of entitlement or insufficiency. There's an openness and willing to contribute, give back, transforming our relationships with people and things and the earth and life itself from that one-way street to, or a transaction, into a sacred bond. But there's a tricky thing about language, concepts. The best that we can imagine as human beings, using our concepts and imagery, a bond, love, sacred bond, relationship, all of these concepts are still dualistic. In other traditions, we might say nature loves you or God loves you. But in Zen, we point toward the independent dimension, toward this reality in which there is not two. So how does this seamless reality, this not two, result in a sense that the sun shines down on me, I want to, and I feel like I deserve it? Along the dimension of not two, there is no separate self. That is just a conception, which has some basis in the dependent dimension. You know, my body is not your body. We're clear about that. But right here, right now, you know, what is a human being? I am what I have eaten. I am the air that I am breathing. I am who I am in relation to everyone else. So even when you explore in the dependent dimension, you realize this isn't, the distinctions that we make are useful, but there's not any fixed boundary to them that has some kind of inherent reality. It's much more permeable and flowing and boundless than that. So if there's no separate self in this sense, what is intimate or affirming about it? What does this not to have to do with the self and our relationship to the world, this self that wants to feel like it belongs and doesn't have to earn the right to be here? So this is something each of us needs to experience for ourselves. But in essence, you know, the two dimensions are simultaneously true. And in the independent dimension, along the independent dimension, not in, I'm trying to not use the word in because it sounds like you could be over there in that dimension when you can't. Along the independent dimension, there is this one seamless reality of which you are a part. It would not be the same without you. And along the independent dimension, there are no distinctions between more or less important, central and peripheral, big and small. So in this, things as it is, there's no like, well, even you as a small little person over there are important to the whole. It's like the distinctions aren't made there. And things as it is, this moment, you are surrounded by an infinite number of supports you could not and did not earn. So we move and act along the dependent dimension of reality, but belonging is always true as well. We deserve the warmth of the sun, but it's really better or more accurate from the Zen point of view to say, I am the sun. The sun is me. Warmth is me. Warmth is the sun. It's more intimate than deserving. Just as we don't say the hand expresses love for the stomach when it puts food in our mouth. But the result of this situation is similar in that we can recognize our place in the world isn't dependent on the performance of the small self. So our practice is to explore and move closer and closer to having a personal experience, a sense of this independent dimension of reality, and then developing that into an appreciation for how dependent and independent are simultaneously true and interpenetrating. It's the study of a lifetime. But our practice is also to act in accord with what we intuit to be true and what the ancestors and teachers assure us is true. So by acting in accord and watching carefully what happens, not just accepting blindly, oh, you know, Buddhism says blah, 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 so I'll act like that. We act in accord and we remain mindful. What happens? And by doing this, we can verify the truth for ourselves through our actions. It's like, on the one hand, we can get some kind of insight into gravity, or we can walk around and verify how gravity works through our experience. So acting in accord. This is where I'm thinking of right confidence. I don't know if this is the best term for this, but, and again, the term right meaning this is what works. Contrasting right confidence, which I'll get to in a moment, with limited confidence. So limited confidence would be confidence in the small self, in the capacities of, or merits of the small self, or that circumstances will work out to the benefit of the small self somehow. And it might be easiest to get our minds around, you know, what this feels like and the shortcomings of it, where the antonyms of that are doubt, fear, hesitation, and distrust. So as long as we're relying on limited confidence, like its near enemy can come up. We have to, you know, depending on the small self to keep us from the doubt, fear, hesitation, distrust. Do we have what it takes? We're exhausted. Can we let go now? Will people find out how insufficient we actually are? In this transactional world, are we going to lose our place? Will the sun turn its back on us? So right confidence means somehow acting as if, summoning the sense that no matter who you are or what you do or what happens, you belong, you are part. So synonyms would be faith, courage, readiness, and trust. We wonder, do we have what it takes? And then our answer to that can be, that's not the right question. What matters most cannot be gained or lost. To the question, will people find out how insufficient we actually are? We can say absolutely. And those who are part of your Sangha, your Buddhist Sangha or your larger world Sangha, will embrace the inherent insufficiency we all have within the larger context of this completeness. In this transactional world, are we going to lose our place? Yes. But we cannot lose this place. And will the sun turn its back on us? You cannot turn your back on yourself. So we can work from either end. You can imagine, you can kind of summon this right confidence, like we summon metta sometimes. Just like imagine what it would feel like. Well, how would it feel like if I move into this situation, summoning that kind of right confidence? Or from the other end is to work on mindfulness of your sense of having to earn the sun's warmth or however that manifests. And then summon a question that works for you and hold it. What does it feel like to think I deserve it or that I don't have to earn it? In what sense is the sun me and I am the sun? So I will leave it there. I don't know if that was a little too obscure for questions, but open it for comments and questions. And as usual, we'll just sit here for a minute if nothing arises, just give ourselves some time. And for anyone who's not familiar, there is a There's a reactions button at the bottom of the Zoom screen, and if you press it, there's a raise hand feature, and then your little hand will go up and I'll be able to call on you.
Tomia, what was that you read?
Bearing sweetgrass. I mean braiding, sorry. Braiding sweetgrass. It's a book.
Okay. Thanks.
Katie.
Well, when you were telling that story or reading that story, it reminded me of like conversations that I've had with friends or, you know, especially people that are pretty hardcore environmental. They'll even go farther than that the earth doesn't love you back. It's more like they'll do a cautionary tale where they'll say, and you know, if we push it too far, earth doesn't really care about us. It, you know, we'll just go away. And so that's, you know, I've always thought that was kind of dark, but actually sort of accepted it as a truth. I guess it is a truth. But, I just was, you know, when you were talking about that, I thought they kind of came up as that whole line of discussion kind of came up in my mind as, oh my, maybe that's a harmful, maybe that's even a harmful way to talk and think that, you know, the earth is just going to spin us off and move on. I don't know, something to think about.
Well, I mean, I was trained as an ecologist first. I mean, I don't, you recognize this is like a cultural dogma almost that many of us have adopted. And I think that, or maybe there's more than one, right? There's the, God gave us the planet to have dominion over and use up as we like.
Right.
And then the other dogma, the kind of reactionary dogma, is like, we are just a scourge on this planet.
Yes.
Like we just ruin everything and use it up, and everything we touch turns bad, and we just don't belong here. And maybe we just, you know, stick around anyway, but that is a terrible sense to carry around. And I feel like that's what Kimmerer's book is really, really beautifully addresses. So because she does have indigenous ancestry, you know, she's legit, but she doesn't, she's not dumbing it down. You know, she's sharing very sincere, she's not stereotyping or something, but she has experience with, you know, different indigenous ways of looking at things, their mythology and their interactions with nature. And the most striking thing, because she grounds it in botany and what we learn from plants, and it is a complete delusion that North America was free of people before we got here. People have been living here for tens of thousands of years, and we're beginning to learn how integrated they were with nature. Now we're beginning to realize, oh, like they stopped the Native Americans in California from burning forests because they were like, oh, it's just wasteful and it's going to ruin the timber. And it turns out that they had evolved this way of interacting with and caring for the forest. So like this change of mindset that like we are here to stay. How do we be part instead of separate? I don't know. I find it very, very hopeful and challenging. And as she points out, like it's better for us to think in these terms that we belong and we have a responsibility and that it's a reciprocal relationship. Because the other way is just It doesn't leave us many options besides just killing ourselves, frankly. Yashitsugi.
One of the things that I look at is language. And when people commit hate crimes or the military is training people to go to war, they talk about the people that they want them to kill or to attack as objects, rather than seeing them as people. So there are Yids, there are Japs, there are da 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 da, there are Blacks, you know, it's or whatever term you want to use. But anyway, if it's an object, it's okay to attack it and kill it because it's not human anyway. It's of no value. And so in my own language, I don't say, oh, I'm listening to the Domio now, I'm listening to the Chris now, or I'm listening to the Pat, or I'm listening to the Mark. So why do I say I'm walking on the earth, or I'm listening to the trees? And so I just started dropping all the does. I'm with earth right now. I'm with trees right now. I'm with wind. I'm with water. I'm with sky. And for me, that removes the objectification and fosters more intimacy and more oneness. Anyway, just wanted to share.
Well, I think you'd love Kimmerer's book because she has a whole chapter on language, and I can't remember the name of the language that, you know, her people spoke, but there are no it pronouns for trees, and you know they have to use the same pronouns for trees and water and animals as us, and they call them the tree people and the bird people, and you know, it's just like, wow, if we thought about things in those terms, it'd be so different.
There's also some culture, a Native American culture, they don't even have nouns. So like trees would be dancing in wind. It's because it's in a relationship. Everything is in relationship, where a noun again separates you out as an object separate from.
Etsu.
Well, I want to thank you for sharing that wonderful reading, Domio, and it certainly brought up a lot of images, you know, in that sense of deserving and belonging. And one of the images that came up, and it was a really sad image, is our children who are caught in social media and have this sense that they need to really alter their appearance to feel like they belong or accept, you know, to the extreme that, you know, they'll undergo surgeries to look like a Barbie doll. And you know, I think that's really sad that they're kind of driven by this sense of unbelonging to do all of that. So on the one hand, that really sad image about not belonging, not deserving. I don't deserve to be accepted unless I look like this, right? And then the other extreme that came to mind about the belonging part was that image of the Buddha at the time of enlightenment. What happened there? He reached down and touched the earth. Reached down and touched the earth. I mean, and if there's any image of intimacy with earth, that's a potent image that I belong and the earth is my witness, you know? You know, and I think in the West, we're very much on a self-improvement project, you know, Zen can just be another part of the big self-improvement. It's like another filter for my phone. You know? and it'd be hard to just touch the earth and know that we just belong in this moment. So anyway, I wanted to share those images that came up, and thank you again for sharing that.
Thank you. Ruth Ann, did you want to say something?
Yes, in Robin's book, her sense of reciprocity is that sacred bound, but like with language, we can do both and, because just like in the song, there's the shift. So awakening doesn't happen overnight, so we can be with the earth. We are part of the earth, whatever aspect we can embrace, and yet not beat ourselves up, because the culture has given us totally different messages. So the Zen is just a way of embracing the both and that, okay, here's what's happening, but we are Earth, and just let it be. I mean, sit with it and find ways to open to it. Thank you for this talk.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Dave and Zendo here.
I have a question. I'm trying to get my head around all that stuff. And I know that when, you know, we recite our vow to strive for the awakening of all sentient beings, and I've heard of, you know, at times that sentient being word extends to things like rocks and trees. Is that related, do you think?
It's interesting, and definitely there's a lot of imagery in Chan and Zen that are like there's like Dogen has the teachings of the insentient, and yeah, like rocks and trees and rivers and mountains walk and all of these things. I think there's a time when it's useful to make that distinction, and then, but ultimately there is no distinction, right? So the sentient part is basically an acknowledgement that sentient beings suffer in a particular way because of their kind of consciousness of separateness, perhaps. That is kind of the very definition. And we know that even though maybe as human beings we can suffer existentially in a way that most animals cannot, that still they suffer. Like even plants suffer, right? They have that sense of self-protection. So I think that's just a nod toward we have particular concern for these poor beings who suffer and can alleviate some of that suffering through practice. And yet, ultimately the life force is not like only contained in sentient beings. Does that help?
Maybe.
I mean, one of my favorite things is to. I'm not sure about this because I haven't studied Vajrayana, Tibetan Buddhism, but I heard once that one of the things that they say is like the characteristic of the universe is like liveliness. There's just universal liveliness. And I love that sense that is what this universe is, not a void, you know? What is there? There's just all this manifestation of molecules and stardust and cells, and something causes things to come together and form life and unfold. And that is the great mystery, which goes beyond humanity, and it goes beyond me, and it goes beyond sentient beings. So Somebody raised their hand online, but then now it's gone.
I had it up and then I took it down.
Ah.
One of the things that occurred to me was because there are animals, at least animals that are self-aware, they've got enough brain matter, like elephants and porpoises come to mind. Anyway, I'm just wondering in terms of what you were saying, is it that people are more apt to create dukkha than other forms of liveliness on Earth?
Who knows, right? We might find out someday.
It's perhaps a rhetorical question.
Yeah. We may very well find out someday that, you know, elephants suffer from depression and existential angst.
Oh, yeah.
Why wouldn't they, you know?
Okay, so I would agree with that. And I'd also agree that there are some animals who have a poor me, pity me attitude. And you have to work with them very differently from the animals who feel like, I've got this under control, I can do this. And those animals will, which animals follow which animals? They're not going to follow those overly sentimental, poor me ones, because they're not going to get to the food and water that they need. They're going to follow the ones, I got this. Mm. I'm connected.
Interesting.
So I'm undoing what I just said. I'm taking it back.
Right. I will say our closing verse. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha Prajna Paramita. Thank you all for being here.